From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This program is made possible in part through the generous support of State of Belief listeners. We're very thankful for every one of you. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, Tuesday brings the Baha'i observance of the first day of the 12-day festival of Ridvan. Wednesday is the Christian St. George Day, and sundown on Thursday night marks the beginning of the Jewish celebration of Yom HaAtzmaut, Israel Independence Day. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's State of Belief radio show.
An El Al flight from New York to Tel Aviv encountered a number of delays after a group of ultra-Orthodox men refused to sit next to women.
It's a subject that's received a flurry of attention in the press in recent weeks. Ultra-Orthodox Jewish men board a commercial airliner and proceed to insist that other passengers accommodate their religious need to not sit next to female passengers, regardless of what seats have been assigned to whom. Most recently, a flight to Israel was delayed for hours. Now, this is a fascinating example of the tension between religious liberty, particularly as defined by fundamentalist beliefs, on the one hand, and the rights of all of us in a free and open society on the other. And on top of that, there's the question of how this affects the women involved. Dr. Ilana Stockman, a leading scholar and author working at the intersection of Orthodox Judaism and feminism, was on her way home to Israel from a U.S. book tour when she was forced to confront this tension head on. She'll be with us to discuss this issue in this hour of State of Belief.
Our religious liberty, our free speech, keeping our freedom to be free from government coercion, I think, is right at the heart of the family and preserving the Judeo-Christian values of this country.
Out of their faith, they want to act on their faith and may not be able to be employed, for example, or may not want to provide services for a gay wedding. People, I think, have the right to do that.
We believe that religious freedom is both a fundamental human right and an essential element to any stable, peaceful, thriving society.
First Amendment says keep government out of religion, doesn't say keep religion out of government.
As the list of White House wannabes grows longer, so does the inevitable appeal to voters in appropriately and inappropriately religious language. What are we hearing? What do we need to be wary of? On this week's show, we'll look at this issue with investigative journalist Sarah Posner. But first,
a lawmaker from Sanford is pushing legislation that would allow some adoption agencies to reject applications from same-sex couples. Opponents say it's discrimination, but it's still cleared a key House hurdle today.
There's been widespread concern about proposed changes to Florida's adoption laws that would allow agencies to refuse to place kids with LGBT families based on religious convictions, of course. In recent days, it appeared that the state legislature was rethinking this discriminatory stance. For clarity on this volatile issue, I'm happy to be able to turn to Denise Brogan-Cater, Senior Legislative Counsel at Family Equality Council. Denise, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Walton. It's a pleasure to be here.
Would you summarize the trajectory of this initiative in the Florida State House?
The bill was introduced in committee, the Judiciary Committee, where it passed, and ultimately to the full floor of the House of Representatives. Mm-hmm. It passed the House, but there was never a companion bill introduced in the Senate. Mm. So on the Senate side, language almost the same as the House language was introduced as an amendment to a bill that was being considered on the floor of the Senate, mm-hmm. which was the bill that provided adoption incentives for families that were adopting special needs children. Mm-hmm. And part of that bill included the repeal of the gay adoption ban that has been on the books here in Florida since 1977.
Mm-hmm.
So a senator introduced language similar to the language of the House bill, the so-called conscience clause, and that was soundly defeated in the Senate as an amendment, and no one thinks that it will be introduced as a standalone bill. And with just a few weeks left to go in the legislative session, it looks like this bill is dead.
Talk about what role the Family Equality Council has played in this.
In all cases, we try to lift up the voices of the people that are directly affected. So in this particular case, we worked with state and national partners to try and identify families that were affected or would be potentially affected by the passage of this type of bill. And they included families that would or have experienced discrimination because they went to an agency that didn't think their religious beliefs comported with the religious beliefs of the family and were turned away. And they also included gay and lesbian foster care and adoptive parents and their children, frankly. And so we were able to bring several of those folks to the statehouse to testify against this bill, and I myself testified against the bill. And we also worked on raising public awareness through social media posts, letters to the editor. We put out an action alert to all of our families in the state of Florida asking them to reach out to their senators and representatives expressing their hope that this bill would be killed.
A couple of years ago, Catholic Charities terminated its adoption placement services in Illinois in response to a demand for inclusivity. Is it just a matter of how this issue is addressed state by state, or do you see a trend, and is the trend going in the right direction or the wrong direction?
This didn't just happen in Illinois. It also happened in Massachusetts and in San Francisco. The important thing to remember in every one of those cases is that services to children were never impacted by that. In fact, in Massachusetts, Catholic Charities had been placing children with same-sex couples previous to marriage equality coming to Massachusetts. Once marriage equality came to Massachusetts, the Catholic hierarchy came out and said, you can't do this anymore. You can no longer place children with gay and lesbian families. And so they left the market. But several of the people involved with Catholic Charities also left Catholic Charities, formed a new child placement agency, and there was never a hiccup in services at all to the children.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the important thing here. All of this is really about focus on best interests of the children. And this legislation in Florida, as was true in other places, was designed without considering best interests of children first.
Mm-hmm.
In Florida, there is not a lack of child placement agencies, so there's no concern that people in child placement agencies will leave and we will be unable to provide services for children. There are plenty of child placement agencies. The concern is, do we have enough parents who are willing to put themselves and their homes out to a child and provide a loving and forever home?
Mm-hmm.
That we need to encourage. That's where the lack is. And so trying to protect these families that are willing to provide forever loving homes is the most important thing, and that's what's in the best interest of children. The impact on a child when you hear from your government that your family is less valued than somebody else's family is, it's like state-sanctioned rejection. And all of us know that children of all ages seek to fit in. They seek to belong. They need love and stability. And when that is challenged by the very government that is there to provide for them, it has a tremendous debilitating effect emotionally, psychologically on these children.
I am curious, Denise, all of this conversation that's now going on about religious freedom, certainly it's becoming popular in the culture wars. I have grave concerns because I think the people talking most about it don't even understand religious freedom. But how does the Family Equality Council frame its agenda in this very dynamic conversation about religious freedom?
I think we, as any organization like ours, feels that religious freedom is a fundamental right in our country, and it should be vigorously protected. We believe in the right of individuals to worship according to their faith, to believe as they believe, as the doctrines of their religious organization or affiliation dictate. We believe deeply in that. Many of us ourselves are people of faith. It is when religious belief comes into conflict with another basic right. So we know that religious freedom is guaranteed by the First Amendment of the Constitution. And we have another right that is guaranteed by the 14th Amendment of the Constitution, and that's the right to equal protection under the law. And the challenge is when those two rights of all of us as Americans come into conflict. And many people, particularly on the conservative right, will try to tell you that they are in conflict. But in fact, they are not as much in conflict as they would have you believe. This religious conscience bill, for example, or the bill in Indiana that got so much attention. These bills are not designed to protect the religious belief and the religious liberty of a group of people. They are more designed to remove the equal protection of the law from a class of people. And that's a really important distinction. The right to discriminate, the right to bring harm to a group of people is part and parcel of no religion I can think of. And so I think that this conflict between the First and the 14th Amendment is manufactured very often, and we try to call out that difference.
That is so well said, and I appreciate the position you all take on it. Tell our listeners, if you will, how they can learn more about the work of Family Equality Council and how they can get involved.
You can go to www.familyequality.org on our website, and there is the links at the very top of the page, which will tell you about how to get informed about the work and how to get involved in the work. And we would appreciate all of your listeners doing exactly that.
Denise Brogan-Cater is the Senior Legislative Counsel at Family Equality Council. Denise, thank you so much for being with us on State of Belief Radio.
Well, it's my personal pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Every day seems to be bringing a new official entry into the 2016 Presidential Derby. Predictably, some of the candidates have not been shy about injecting religious rhetoric into their appeals for support. Here to talk about this perennial problem is investigative journalist Sarah Posner. Sarah, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thanks, Welton. It's nice to be back.
Are you ready to go through this again?
No.
I'm not either. I thought the other day, as much as I love covering this stuff, I also get sick of it.
Well, I would like to see somebody do something a little bit different this time. I want somebody to surprise me. Somebody already has.
Okay, well, tell us about the surprise.
So the person who has surprised me was Rand Paul. And he went on Daystar Television a few weeks ago before he officially announced. And the only reason why a potential presidential candidate would go on Daystar Television, home to, you know, prosperity televangelists and name it and claim it theology, would be to appeal to their evangelical and Pentecostal audience. And Paul is a mainline Protestant. He goes to a Presbyterian church. And when he was asked about his faith, he gave a very sort of, I thought, honestly skeptical answer.
Hmm.
He said, you know, I don't know if somebody needs to be saved more than once, but, you know, there have definitely been times, paraphrasing, definitely been times in my life when I've doubted my faith or I've, you know, questioned my faith, but I always come back to it. But to, you know, suggest that perhaps his salvation wasn't ironclad and that he had doubts and that he had doubts about God when he looks at the terrible things that happen in the world, I mean, that was a very unusual thing for a Republican presidential candidate to say.
It's pretty clear you don't have him mixed up with Ted Cruz or Governor Huckabee, do you?
I do not, although I'm sure he would love to have their voters. So I think that is the little bind that he finds himself in, and that's why he went on Daystar. He'll probably do more of those kind of religious outreach appearances, but I don't think he has the rhetoric down.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, that's refreshing.
Yes.
He went on there and he didn't give the usual salvation testimony that that audience is led to expect.
Mm-hmm.
He said something very straightforward and that I think a lot of people experience, that they doubt their faith sometimes,
yeah,
but they always come back to it.
Well, contrast that approach to Huckabee's approach or Ted Cruz's approach?
Well, let's talk about Cruz because he has officially announced. Huckabee hasn't. Cruz officially announced his candidacy at Liberty University.
Mm-hmm.
The speech that he gave was laden with religious references. The audience was clearly intended to be a receptive audience to that sort of message. He's clearly gunning for the same audience that Huckabee was gunning for in 2008 and that Michelle Bachmann was gunning for in 2012. And this is the audience where, you know, my way or the highway, my own salvation is tied up with a patriotic story about God and country in the United States and the founding of America. And only faith in God, and in particular in Jesus, will restore America to her Christian foundation or her Judeo-Christian foundation. That's the sort of message that Cruz is sending. He's mixed it with a Tea Party anti-government message. This is a very similar message to Bachmann. It's not that similar to Huckabee's in 2008, but I think should Huckabee get in the race again, his is going to sound more like Cruz than the 2008 version of himself.
In your mind, is it true that we're going to hear the worst abuse or manipulation of religious language in the primaries, and we'll have to wait until after the conventions to get to the two candidates who are actually running against each other most prominently before we get religion a little bit more sanely presented or more subtly presented?
My guess is that we're going to, on the Republican side, end up with a candidate who is not the worst abuser of mixing religion with campaigning.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just because that's been the pattern over the past several election cycles. In 2008, you had Huckabee. In 2012, you had Bachmann and Rick Perry. And, you know, what you end up at the end is a John McCain or a who was the guy who ran the last time? Mitt Romney. Sorry.
Yes.
I had a little brain freeze there. And I think this time it seems kind of likely that we will end up not with a Ted Cruz or a Mike Huckabee, but with a Jeb Bush, a Scott Walker, or a Marco Rubio.
Mm-hmm.
And each of those candidates does use religion, just not like a Cruz or a Huckabee.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it will be a little bit more subtle. It will be an attempt to be a little bit more inclusive, and it will definitely dance around some of the issues that they're worried could alienate general election voters, and that's the Supreme Court's upcoming decision on same-sex marriage and all the religious freedom bills that we've seen percolating in the states in reaction to that.
Sarah, we talked about Republican candidates that have already announced. We now have a Democratic candidate that's already announced. How do you anticipate Hillary Clinton handling religious language and pervasively religious issues?
Well, you know, Hillary Clinton is a religious person. She is a lifelong Methodist, and she has a strong social justice sort of take on religion. And I think given her rollout video and given her recent language, I think that, I mean, I hope that we won't see a replay of 2008. I thought that the Democrats' performance on religion was cringeworthy in 2008. I hope it's a little more likely that she won't use that sort of language on the hot-button culture war issues. I mean, she's already changed her position on same-sex marriage from 2008, so she's for it, so that really won't be an issue. But on abortion, I'm thinking that the climate has changed since 2008 and that there will be less of that sort of abortion reduction, safe, legal, and rare kind of rhetoric, and more of a robust pro-choice rhetoric coming from Clinton. This is my prediction. I could be wrong. And I think that I would expect that to the extent that she invokes religion, it will be for emphasizing, government's treatment of the poor, or society's treatment of the poor and children and so on. But who knows? I mean, something could change, but it seems to me that given the circumstances of 2016 or 2015 versus 2007 and 2008, I expect it to be a little bit different.
Sarah, you mentioned the really anticipated Supreme Court decision of grave importance for the nation. Do you think that the Supreme Court decision on marriage equality will become a major presidential campaign issue?
I think that the religious right wants to hear the Republican presidential candidates talk about what's next. What's next after a Supreme Court ruling holding these same-sex marriage bans unconstitutional? And I think that the conversation about the state religious freedom laws, like we saw in Indiana and Arkansas, that conversation is not over. And I think that there will be an expectation by the religious right for the Republican candidates to express their views about that. Now, we've already seen candidates backpedal when they realized how unpopular the Indiana legislation was. So when the Indiana legislation first hit the media a couple weeks ago, Jeb Bush strongly sided with Indiana Governor Mike Pence, who wanted this legislation that he ultimately ended up changing it under political pressure, but the piece of legislation that he was supporting would have permitted discrimination against LGBT people by business owners. So, but I think you very quickly saw Bush backpedal from that when he saw what was happening with opposition to the bill, with business opposition to the bill. And I think this is where the Republican candidates are really going to be squeezed. They're going to be squeezed between the religious right that wants to hear them say, I support some kind of religious freedom bills or a bolstering of religious freedom bills at the state level, because that's necessary to protect the religious conscience of people who oppose same-sex marriage. But then on the other hand, this is extremely unpopular in most demographics outside the religious right and is extremely unpopular with business interests. So I think it's tough, you know, when the religious right is opposing NASCAR and Walmart.
Sarah, I'm a voter. You're a voter. There are other potential voters listening to us right now. If one of those voters, or many of them, are trying to evaluate candidate positions while filtering out inappropriate religious appeals, what do they need to look for?
Well, I think that, voters can look at in-depth news stories about the candidates that explore their record if they've held public office before. Most of them have. Ben Carson is one exception to that. and see what their record was when they were actually, you know, serving as a governor or a senator or a member of the House of Representatives. That gives you a lot of information, and you can listen to speeches that they give to different audiences. You know, you can see some candidates give the same speech regardless of who the audience is.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that because of this, you know, this divide in the Republican Party over these religious freedom bills and the divide between the religious right and the business community, you're probably going to see very different sorts of speeches to very
mm-hmm.
different sorts of interests.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, obviously each voter has to evaluate for him or herself, you know, the sincerity or authenticity of the candidates when they're speaking to these audiences. But, you know, we're not lacking for media coverage of these candidates, and often it's very good and very in-depth and goes far back in their careers, and that can be very informative.
Sarah Posner is an investigative journalist of the First Order who writes widely about religion and politics for The Washington Post, The Guardian, The Atlantic, The American Prospect, The Nation, Salon, and Religion Dispatches. Sarah is the author of the book God's Prophets, Profits, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Values Voters. Sarah, we're just getting started on this subject. It's going to be a long campaign season. We're going to have a lot of opportunities, I hope, to talk together about this. But I thank you for getting us off to a good start. It's always great to have you on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Wilton. It was my pleasure.
There have been several press reports recently of ultra-Orthodox Jewish airline passengers demanding to be seated away from women, regardless of their seat assignments. Dr. Ilana Stockman has been writing compellingly on the Orthodox Jewish experience from a feminist perspective for a long time. She's the author of the new book, The War on Women in Israel, A Story of Religious Radicalism and the Women Fighting for Freedom. We've reached Ilana in Israel just back from a U.S. book tour, which included her own travel experience that she described movingly on her blog, JewFilm.com. Ilana, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you for having me.
So, recent pieces in the New York Times and the British press describe this phenomenon as an inconvenience to fellow passengers. You describe it as more than that.
It's a little bit more than an inconvenience. An inconvenience would be something like, well, you like the aisle seat and I like the window seat, so can we work something out that will be, you know, mutually beneficial? This isn't about sort of personal taste. It's not about convenience. It's about a basic premise of who the human being and who isn't. It's this kind of erasure of women from the landscape of humanity. It's basically saying we need to create a women-free zone, a women-free society, a women-free public space so that it's, you know, safe, sort of, you know, in quotes, so that it's safe for ultra-Orthodox religious men. That's what this is about, and that's why it's so difficult, because it really dehumanizes women. It turns women into just non-people.
You wrote about the irony of this happening on your airplane trip home from your book tour. Tell us about that.
Right. Well, you know, that's really hard. So, I wrote this book, which documents all the different ways that this ultra-Orthodox culture is taking over in Israel and trying to occupy public spaces and try to create many public spaces, not just airplanes, that are free of women. You know, it's happening on buses, and it's happening in municipalities, and it's happening in, you know, events of the health ministry and the events of other ministries. It's happening in cemeteries where women are asked to not eulogize their loved ones or are literally, like, pushed aside from burials. So my book really documents all these different locations of this phenomenon, and I went around talking to all kinds of different groups about it, but not to ultra-Orthodox groups. Those weren't my audiences. My audiences were much more mixed and diverse. so when I got on the plane, you know, on my way home, and this happened to me, you know, where this group of ultra-Orthodox men were all around me, and nobody would sit down next to me because, you know, I'm tainted because I'm a woman. So, you know, I sat there for about 20 minutes or 30 minutes watching the man who was supposed to sit next to me, you know, try to manipulate his way into another seat. He was, you know, walking up and down the aisle and, you know, sort of very sort of anxiously talking to all his different friends. And I was watching it. I was watching him do this, and I kept thinking to myself, I want to talk to him. You know, I wanted to, like, say something, but I didn't. Because you're always torn between the feeling of, like, you know, don't make a scene, don't make a thing, don't turn yourself into a spectacle. You know, you don't really want to do that. Versus the feeling of, like, well, you really should speak up. Like, speak up. You have a voice, speak. And I was just imagining myself, you know, speaking to all kinds of different audiences and engaging in, you know, civilized discussions about what this culture means. And I was talking to a lot of religious Jews also, because this is not what most religious Jews want. So, you know, I come from a religious Jewish family. I've been a practicing religious Jew for, you know, my whole life. And I know that this is not what everybody wants. This is a really extreme version, but it's an extreme version that is sort of violently, like, taking over. So, you know, so I'm watching him, and I'm thinking to myself, like, how can I go around the country talking to people, but not talk to the actual people who I'm confronted with? You know, am I possibly dehumanizing ultra-Orthodox men by not engaging directly? I felt, you know, sort of like hypocritical. And so finally, after watching him, I said, you know what, I really need to speak. And I need to speak directly and, you know, speak to them as human beings just as I want them to speak to me as human beings. You know, that's really the basic premise of all of this.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, look, can I say something? And so I tried to, so he said yes, even though he didn't look at me directly. But he said, sure, you know, he was packing up, getting ready to go. I wanted to put it into language he could understand. So I said, look, how would you feel if you as a group of Jewish men got onto an airplane and suddenly a group of non-Jewish men came and said, oh, we can't sit next to you because it's against our religion, or because you're impure, or because you cause us to have impure thoughts, or because you're really on a higher level than us, but we can't, you know, go near you. Like, no matter how you try to rationalize it, it's still hurtful. I said, how would you feel? Anyway, so this whole group of men, I guess I was talking sort of loud because, you know, like, the airplane is a noisy place and there's a lot going on. And so I was talking loud enough so that the people sitting across the aisle from me could hear. And they all sort of looked at me for a second. And then, boom, all of them turned around, and suddenly I find myself staring at a wall of black backs, black-coated backs. Like, all of them, like 10, 15 men all at once, stopped talking, stopped what they were doing, and just turned around and showed me their backs. It was incredible. Like, it was just like you felt like you didn't even exist. You know, you felt like you're sitting there in outer space somewhere, just sort of talking words that are going to land in the next galaxy, like they're going to evaporate and not exist anymore. That's what it felt like. It felt like I was just talking to nothing, you know, and so that was so completely dehumanizing, you know, so that was really, really hard.
So how was it resolved? How did you resolve it?
He went and found another seat. He found another seat, and somebody else came to sit next to me. A non-Orthodox man, actually. It wasn't even a woman. And so we chatted for a while, and, you know, but yeah. But then, you know, I didn't really, I sat there, you know, after he left, you know, and after I saw this wall of black around me, you know, I just sort of sat there, and I started to cry. Like, I don't know, I was, like, really surprised at myself, actually, that I was crying. Like, I was like, why am I taking this so hard? But it was such, it was just really hard, you know. I had spent 2 weeks talking about all these things from that sort of clinical academic perspective. You know, I spent 5 years doing this research and collecting this information, and, you know, I do this professionally. But, you know, talking about all of these things and trying to pretend that it's not as painful as it is, you know, it was like this sort of wall broke inside of me. It just sort of, You know, it's like it's really, really painful, you know, to live as a woman surrounded by this kind of culture which sees you as somebody who cannot speak publicly, who cannot be seen, who needs to be covered and needs to be invisible, where the real desire is to have a world free of people like me. You know, that's so hard to keep confronting. It's so hard to keep to try to live with. And so it just sort of like, boom, like it just sort of came crashing down for me. It was just really hard.
Ilana, I found that the highly respected Jewish scholar, the late Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, insisted mm-hmm. that Orthodox Jewish teachings requires avoiding seeking out sexual gratification on planes and buses, but doesn't forbid any contact with women at all. How did we get to this new level of gender phobia?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. Yeah, Moshe Feinstein ruled that men could ride the subway, right? That mm-hmm. Orthodox men could ride the subway. You have to learn to control your thoughts. That was his ruling, that, you know, if you find yourself having sexual thoughts about the women around you on the subway, then think about something else. Think about Torah. Think about the Bible. Think about, you know, something mm-hmm. else. Think about anything. Think about mushrooms if you have to. But, you know, his ruling was that, you know, that it can... So really what we're seeing is that in the last 20 years, there's been an increasing radicalization in the Jewish community. I think it's not just in the Jewish community. I think it's actually paralleled in many religions around the world. That the last 20, 25 years has mm-hmm. really seen religions everywhere getting more radical, especially around women's bodies. You know, mm-hmm. Geraldine Brooks wrote about it in her book, Nine Parts of Desire. She wrote about it, what's happening in the Muslim world as religions become more radical. The first thing they do is, as Islam becomes more radical, the first thing they is covering women's bodies with scarves and hijabs. And, you mm-hmm. know, so this idea that in order to be more religious, first this community has to cover up the women, that's pretty ubiquitous, actually. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can see it in America in some ways, too. Like, I think that's some of what we're seeing coming out of the Christian right in America.
Absolutely.
Where it comes to, you know, modesty and birth control and even contraception. We're seeing radicalization there, too. Wherever religion goes and decides to become more strict or extreme, the first thing is controlling women's bodies. It's everywhere. And it's really been happening a lot in the last generation or so.
So, Ilana, what – I mean, because I agree with you, especially in the Abrahamic religions, in the fundamentalist expressions of those, we see it all the time. What resolution do you see for these kinds of conflicts once a claim of religious mandate comes up against civility in a secular context?
Yeah, so that's a really interesting question. From my experience in Israel, it might not be the same – in America. But in Israel, there's no official separation of religion and state.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a real fundamental problem. And we're seeing it now, you know, Israel's in the middle of coalition talks, and so we're watching, you know, Prime Minister Netanyahu, or will soon be Prime Minister, we're watching him give away the government to religious parties because he needs to get the religious parties into his coalition in order to govern. So this is a really big problem in Israel because it empowers religious parties, which then empower religious leaders on the ground, and they sort of feel like, oh, we can take over public spaces. We can demand that buses are a certain way, that streets are a certain way. You know, there are cities in Israel that have signs on the streets which say women are not allowed to walk down the street, you know, and that's accompanied by rock throwing. You know, there's a whole group of women in the city of Beit Shemesh who have been hurt by thrown rocks because they walked down the wrong street. So how does this happen? It happens because in Israel you have, you know, the government empowering religious parties who then empower their people who think like, oh, the public space is ours. We can tell the public what to do. So the first thing that has to happen, I think, is that there really needs a top-down shift of thinking where you know, the powers that be and the cabinet and the Knesset understand what the implications are of giving power to religious parties mm-hmm. and what a huge threat is, and it needs to be prioritized to stop that. Right now, there's no priority. Prime Minister Netanyahu has not anywhere made it a priority to hold to hold back religious parties from taking over. I mean, he himself doesn't have such a great record when it comes to women. You know, the last Knesset, he had two women on his cabinet out of 24. So we're not talking about a place where there's such a great consciousness about women's equality to begin with. So the first thing that really has to happen is we need to really build a consensus that protecting women is a fundamental value of any democratic system.
That's exactly right. Do you want to go beyond that?
Yes, exactly. You want to go beyond that, right? You know, that's just a foundation.
Right.
It's just a basic foundation to basically say, you know, women are human beings.
Tell us about your new book, please, and what kind of responses you're getting.
Thank you so much for asking me about my book. So the book is called The War on Women in Israel, and it was published about half a year ago by Source Books, and we're very excited about it. In the book, I cover all these different areas of gender segregation on the buses and in public spaces and the accompanying violence. I cover issues also of religion and state having to do with marriage and divorce and the religious monopoly on personal status and what that does to people trying to get married and people trying to get divorced and what it does to converts. I also cover issues of reproductive rights. I also cover issues of the army, which is a big deal now because there's a lot of pressure to get mandatory conscription for religious soldiers. So what's going to happen if this mandatory conscription is what we're seeing already is that there are demands to remove women from spaces in the army. So there's calls to get women out of certain camps and certain training camps and certain positions. And even last week there was a story about women soldiers who were asked to leave the dining hall because a group of religious men wanted to go in. So this is what's going on, you know, everywhere. So the book covers all of these different topics, and I put forth some ideas about how we can stop it and the strategies that are needed to stop it. I also highlight the work of some really amazing non-government organizations in Israel, women's organizations and feminist organizations and organizations advancing pluralism in Israel that are collaborating and working in all kinds of coalitions to try to create a different culture in Israel, so that the book isn't just depressing. Each chapter at the end highlights the positive work that's been done, also in terms of legislation and grassroots activism and using the judicial system to halt the spread of radicalism.
Dr. Ilana Stockman is the author of the new book, The War on Women in Israel, A Story of Religious Radicalism and the Women Fighting for Freedom. She writes widely about feminism and Orthodox Judaism. You can find out more at her website, which is www.jewfem.com. We reached her in Israel today. Ilana, we've got to talk again. I am so proud of what you're doing and know that people around the world need to understand what you're doing because a lot more people need to be doing the same thing. Thank you for being with us today on State of Belief, and I hope we'll talk again soon.
Thank you so, so much. I'm happy to talk to you anytime. Really, thank you so much.
Now, before we go, the modification of religious freedom laws in Indiana and Arkansas has variously been blamed on and credited to protest from the business community. I think it's safe to say that positions taken by everyone from Apple to NASCAR have a lot less to do with a particular set of moral beliefs and more to do with pragmatic business decisions. Fair treatment of both employees and customers is good for commerce, and successful companies need to pay attention to that. Both sides in the culture wars recognize the power that business interests have over civic discourse in our country. And whether or not that power is disproportionate, it needs to be reckoned with. Evidence of that includes a long list of supposedly gay-friendly companies condemned by the far right on a website titled Second Vote. With the slogan, "Go Beyond the Ballot," the site identifies donors to groups like the Human Rights Campaign and brands that are seen as satanically pro-gay marriage. Undoubtedly, there are anti-equality Americans who will avoid these businesses because of their pro-equality stance. But since the hard work of compiling this list has already been done, it would be a shame for those of us who support inclusivity and fairness not to take a look at this same list. Should you wish to express support for those targeted businesses, the website address is www.secondvote.com. They use the numeral 2 in the address, so it's www, the number 2, the letters N, D, then the word vote, .com/marriage. We'll link to it from stateofbelief.com. Second Vote call themselves a new resource for making informed decisions, and indeed they are just that. Just perhaps not always in the way they had in mind. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, good for you and thank you. The ongoing financial support of our listeners is essential for keeping this show on the air. If you find value in what you're hearing, I urge you to join our other generous supporters today. Please visit stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stateofbelief.com is also where you can sign up for our free weekly podcast and find links mentioned during the show. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter and share the stories you find compelling with your friends. Encourage them to start listening. We really need you to help spread the word about State of Belief Radio. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. Next week, I'll be traveling to an interfaith conference in Sri Lanka. And I am grateful that Huffington Post executive religion editor Paul Rauschenbusch has agreed to fill in as host of this show. You'll hear about their exciting What It Means to Be Muslim in America project, and you'll hear much more. So be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief. The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see, he was.